Chapter 99. A Surprise for Hitler. As Colville lay in bed on Sunday morning, for no particular reason, he began thinking about a fanciful novel he had read, whose plot centred on a surprise visit to England by Hitler himself, via parachute. The author was Peter Fleming, the older brother of Ian Fleming. Colville made note of the moment in his diary, awoke thinking unaccountably of Peter Fleming's book Flying Visit, and daydreaming of what would happen if we captured Göring during one of his alleged flights over London. It was rumoured that Göring had flown over the city during one or more air raids. At 8 o'clock, Colville set out from 10 Downing Street to walk to Westminster Abbey, where he planned to attend an early church service. He found a stunning spring day, with bright sun and cerulean skies, but soon encountered great shrouds of smoke. Burnt paper from some demolished paper mill was falling like leaves on a windy autumn day, he wrote. Whitehall was crowded with people, many of them merely out to see the damage, others whose blackened faces suggested they had been up all night fighting fires and rescuing the wounded. A teenage boy, one of the sightseers, pointed in the direction of the Palace of Westminster and asked, "Is that the sun?" But this glow was fire, emanating from the flames of massed blazes still burning south of the Thames. When Colville reached the abbey, he found the way blocked by police officers and fire trucks. He approached the entrance but was stopped by a policeman at the door. "There will not be any services in the abbey today, sir," the officer said. Colville was struck by his quotidian tone, exactly as if it were closed for spring cleaning. The roof of Westminster Hall was still burning with visible flames, and gusts of smoke rose from somewhere behind it. Colville spoke with one of the firemen, who pointed to Big Ben and, with satisfaction, told Colville about the bomb that had passed through the tower. Despite clear signs of damage, Big Ben was indeed still marking out double British summertime, though, as was later determined, the bomb cost the British Empire half a second. Colville walked on to Westminster Bridge, which crosses the Thames directly in front of the tower. Just to the southeast, St. Thomas Hospital was in flames. Fires burned all along the embankment. It was clear that the night's raid had caused deep and lasting damage of a kind the city had not experienced before. "After no previous raid has London looked so wounded the next day," Colville wrote. On his return to 10 Downing, he had breakfast, then telephoned Ditchley to tell Churchill about the damage. "He was very grieved," remarked Colville, "that William Rufus's roof at Westminster Hall should have gone." Colville walked to the Foreign Office to talk with a friend who was Anthony Eden's second private secretary, and just as he entered the office, his friend said into his telephone, "Hold on a minute, I think this is your man." On Sunday morning, Mary and Eric set out for Ditchley, to spend the day with Clementine and Winston and the rest. The night's bombing had closed train stations, which forced the couple to take a roundabout route involving unexpected transfers. This turned the trip from a relatively quick journey into an arduous and tedious one, during which Mary's doubts became more concrete. "I became aware," she wrote, "of very definite misgivings." Pamela's advice kept running through her mind. "Don't marry someone because he wants to marry you." She told Eric of her concerns. He was understanding and gentle, and did what he could to ease her anxiety. They arrived to find Ditchley full of guests, among them Everil Harriman. Immediately Clementine took Mary into her bedroom. In London, at the Foreign Office, Anthony Eden's private secretary placed his hand over the receiver and told Colville that the caller had identified himself as the Duke of Hamilton and was claiming to have news that could only be delivered to Churchill in person. The Duke, if indeed the caller was a Duke, planned to fly himself to the RAF's Northolt Air Base, outside London, and wanted to be met there by one of Churchill's men, meaning Colville, who was on duty at 10 Downing Street that day. The Duke also wanted Alexander Cadogan, Eden's undersecretary, to come along. Colville took the receiver. The Duke declined to offer details, but said his news was like something from a fantasy novel and involved the German aircraft that had crashed in Scotland. "At that moment," Colville wrote, "I vividly remembered my early waking thoughts on Peter Fleming's book, and I felt sure that either Hitler or Göring had arrived." Colville again telephoned Churchill.
"Well, who has arrived?" Churchill asked with irritation.
"I don't know. He wouldn't say.
It can't be Hitler."
"I imagine not," Colville said.
Well, stop imagining and have the Duke, if it is the Duke, sent straight here from Northolt. Churchill directed Colville to ensure, first, that the Duke really was the Duke of Hamilton. On the morning of Sunday, May 11th, Hitler's architect, Albert Speer, came to the Berghof to show him some architectural sketches. In the anteroom to Hitler's office, he found two nervous men, Karl-Heinz Pinch and Alfred Leitgen, both adjutants to Rudolf Hess. They asked Speer if he would permit them to see Hitler first, and Speer agreed. They gave Hitler Hess's letter, which he immediately read. "My Führer," it began, "when you receive this letter, I shall be in England. You can imagine that the decision to take this step was not easy for me, since a man of 40 has other ties with life than one of 20. He explained his motive, to try to bring about a peace settlement with England. And if, my Führer, this project, which I admit has but very small chance of success, ends in failure, and the fates decide against me, this can have no detrimental results either for you or for Germany. It will always be possible for you to deny all responsibility. Simply say I was crazy." Speer was looking through his drawings when he wrote, "I suddenly heard an inarticulate, almost animal outcry." This was the start of one of the tantrums, or Wutausbrüche, that Hitler's men so dreaded. One aide recalled that it was as though a bomb had hit the Berghof. "Bormann at once!" Hitler shouted. "Where is Bormann?" Hitler told Bormann to summon Goering, Ribbentrop, Goebbels, and Himmler. He asked Adjutant Pinch if he knew the contents of the letter. Upon Pinch's affirmation that he did, Hitler ordered him and his fellow adjutant Leitgen arrested and sent to a concentration camp. Albrecht Haushofer was arrested as well and sent to the Gestapo house prison in Berlin for interrogation. He was later released. The other leaders arrived. Goering brought along his chief technical officer, who assured Hitler that it was highly unlikely that Hess would reach his destination. Navigation would be Hess's biggest problem. High winds would almost certainly drive him off course. Hess would probably miss the British Isles completely. This prospect gave Hitler hope. "If only he would drown in the North Sea," Hitler said, according to Albert Speer. "Then he would vanish without a trace, and we could work out some harmless explanation at our leisure." What Hitler most feared was what Churchill would do with the news of Hess's disappearance. At Ditchley, in Clementine's bedroom, Mary now realized for the first time the depth of her mother's misgivings about her engagement to Eric. Clementine told Mary that she and Winston had grave concerns, and that she regretted letting the romance progress to this point without expressing their doubts and fears. This was only partly true. In fact, Churchill, preoccupied with war matters, had few concerns about the engagement and was more than content to let Clementine manage the situation. Thus far that weekend, his main interests had been the Prionites air raid, which appeared to be the worst of the war, and Operation Tiger, a mission to transport a large number of tanks to the Middle East. Clementine demanded that Mary put off the engagement for 6 months. "Bombshell," Mary wrote in her diary. Mary wept, but she knew her mother was right, as she conceded in her diary. "Through my tears I became aware most clearly of her wisdom, and all the doubts, misgivings and fears I had experienced at various times during the last few days seemed to crystallize." Clementine asked Mary if she felt certain about marrying Eric. "In all honesty," Mary wrote, "I could not say I did." Clementine, unable to get her husband's attention, asked Harriman to talk with Mary, then went directly to Eric to tell him her decision to postpone the engagement. Harriman took Mary into Ditchley's formal box garden, where the two walked around and around, Mary crushed and miserable and rather tearful, Harriman trying to console her and offer perspective. "He said all the things I should have told myself," she wrote. "Your life is before you. You should not accept the first person who comes along. You have not met many people. To be stupid about one's life is a crime." As they walked and talked, she grew increasingly certain that her mother was indeed correct, but along with this she felt more and more conscious of my own unintelligent behavior, my weakness, my moral cowardice. She also felt relief. What would have happened had Mummy not intervened? Thank God for Mummy's sense, understanding, and love. Eric was kind to Mary and understanding, but he was furious with Clementine.
Telegrams were fired off, notifying Eric's parents, as well as others, that the engagement had been postponed. Mary had some spiked cider and felt better. She wrote letters until late in the night, went to bed crushed, humiliated but fairly calm. But before this, she and the others all settled into the home theatre at Ditchley to watch a film. Mary sat beside Harriman. The film, appropriately, was called World in Flames. Chapter 100. Blood, Sweat and Tears. As Mary settled into her bed that Sunday night in the peaceful environs of Ditchley, firefighting crews in London struggled to bring the remaining fires under control, and rescue teams dug through rubble, looking for survivors and recovering torn and broken bodies. Whether by design or accident, many bombs had failed to explode, and these kept firefighters and rescuers at bay until technicians could defuse the weapons. In terms of treasures lost, damage done, and deaths inflicted, the raid was the worst of the war. It killed 1,436 Londoners, a record for a single night, and caused grave injury to another 1,792 people. It left some 12,000 people without homes, among them the novelist Rose Macaulay, who returned to her flat on Sunday morning to find that it had been destroyed by fire, along with everything she had accumulated in the course of her lifetime, including letters from her terminally ill lover, a novel in progress, all her clothes, and all her books. It was the loss of the books that she grieved above all. "I keep thinking of one thing I loved after another with a fresh stab," she wrote to a friend. "I wish I could go abroad and stay there. Then I shouldn't miss my things so much. But it can't be. I love my books so much and can never replace them." Among the lost was a collection of volumes published in the 17th century. My Aubrey, my Pliny, my Topsell, Sylvester Drayton, all the poets. Lots of lovely, queer, unknown writers, too. She also lost her collection of rare Baedekers. And anyhow, travel is over, like one's books and the rest of civilization. But the single loss that caused her the greatest sorrow was her Oxford English Dictionary. As she probed the ruins of her home, she found a charred page from the H's. She also exhumed a page from her edition of the famed 17th century diary kept by Samuel Pepys. She made an inventory of the books, at least those she could remember. It was, she wrote in a later essay, the saddest list. Perhaps one should not make it. Now and then an overlooked title would come to mind, like the familiar gesture of a lost loved one. One keeps on remembering some odd little book that one had. One can't list them all, and it is best to forget them now that they are ashes. The most symbolic and infuriating destruction in the May 10th raid occurred when a direct hit destroyed the debating chamber of the House of Commons, where Churchill, just 4 days earlier, had won his vote of confidence. "That old House of Commons has been blown to smithereens," Churchill wrote to Randolph. "You never saw such a sight. Not one scrap was left of the chamber, except a few of the outer walls. The Huns obligingly chose a time when none of us were there." Sunday also brought a strange and welcome calm, as recorded by a 28-year-old mass observation diarist, an affluent widow with two children who lived in Maida Vale, west of Regent's Park, and saw none of the conflagration still underway in Westminster, 3 miles to the southeast. "I drew back the curtains on a day of sunny loveliness and perfect peace," she wrote. "The apple trees in the garden were pink dotted against the luscious, thick-piled whiteness of the pear blossom. The sky was warmly blue. Birds were chirruping in the trees, and there was a gentle Sunday morning quietness over everything. Impossible to believe that last night, from this same window, everything should have been savagely red with fire glow and smoke, and deafening with an inferno of noise." The city braced for another attack on Sunday night, when the moon would be at its fullest, but no bombers came, and none came the next night, or the night after that. The quiet was puzzling. "It may be that they are massing on the Eastern Front as part of their intimidation of Russia," wrote Harold Nicholson in his diary on June 17th. "It may be that their whole air force will be used for a mass attack on our front in Egypt. It may also be that they are equipping their machines with some new device, like wire cutters, to cut the cables of barrage balloons. In any case," he concluded, "it bodes ill." The change was immediately evident in the monthly tallies of the dead kept by the Ministry of Home Security. In May, throughout the United Kingdom, German raids killed a total of 5,612 civilians, of whom 791 were children. In June,
the total plummeted to 410, a drop of nearly 93%. In August, to 162. In December, 37. Oddly enough, this new quiet came at a time when Fighter Command believed it was at last getting a grip on night defense. By now, Number 80 Wing, the radio countermeasures unit, had become adept at jamming and diverting the German beams, and Fighter Command's drive to learn to fight in the dark finally seemed to be paying off. Many twin-engine night fighters were now equipped with air-to-air radar. Pilots of single-engine fighters, flying on fighter nights, also seemed to be hitting their stride. That Saturday night, under a brilliant moon, a combined force of 80 Hurricanes and Defiance, aided by outlying anti-aircraft batteries, shot down at least 7 bombers and seriously damaged a KGR-100 Pathfinder, the best result thus far. From January through May, the rate at which RAF single-engine fighters intercepted German aircraft increased fourfold. On the ground, too, there was a different attitude, this in tune with the overall feeling that England had shown beyond a doubt that it could endure Hitler's onslaught. Now it was time to return the favour. A mass observation diarist who worked as a travelling salesman wrote in his diary, "The spirit of the people seems to be moving from passive to active, and rather than cower in shelters, they prefer to be up and doing. Incendiary seemed to be tackled as though they were fireworks, and tackling fires in top rooms with stirrup pumps is just part of the evening's work. One leader was telling me his chief trouble is to prevent people taking risks. Everyone wants to bag a bomb." And then there was Hess. On Tuesday, May 13th, Joseph Goebbels addressed the affair at his morning propaganda meeting. "History knows a great many similar examples when people lost their nerve at the last moment and then did things which were perhaps extremely well-intended but nevertheless did harm to their country," he said. He assured his propagandists that eventually the incident would recede into its historical context as one episode in the long, glorious story of the Third Reich, even though, naturally, it is not pleasant at the moment. "However, there are no grounds for letting our wings droop in any way or for thinking that we shall never live this down." But Goebbels had clearly been rattled by the episode. "Just as the Reich is on the point of snatching victory, this business must happen," he said at a meeting on Thursday, May 15th. "It is the last hard test of our character and of our staying power, and we feel entirely up to such a trial sent to us by fate." He instructed his lieutenants to revive a propaganda line they had used before the war, which played to the myth of Hitler as a mystical being. "We believe in the Führer's powers of divination. We know that anything which now seems to be going against us will turn out to be most fortunate for us in the end." Goebbels knew, of course, that a profound deflection of public attention would soon arise. "For the moment, we will ignore the affair," he said. "Besides, something is shortly going to happen in the military field which will enable us to divert attention away from the Hess issue to other things." He was referring to Hitler's imminent invasion of Russia. In an official statement, Germany depicted Hess as an ailing man who was under the influence of mesmerists and astrologers. A subsequent commentary called Hess this everlasting idealist and sick man. His astrologer was arrested and sent to a concentration camp. Göring summoned Willy Messerschmitt for a meeting and took him to task for aiding Hess. The Luftwaffe chief asked Messerschmitt how he could possibly have let an individual as obviously insane as Hess have an airplane, to which Messerschmitt offered an arch rejoinder. "How am I supposed to believe that a lunatic can hold such a high office in the Third Reich?" Laughing, Göring said, "You are incorrigible, Messerschmitt." In London, Churchill directed that Hess should be treated with dignity, but also with the awareness that this man, like other Nazi leaders, is potentially a war criminal, and he and his confederates may well be declared outlaws at the close of the war. Churchill approved a War Office suggestion that Hess be housed temporarily in the Tower of London until a permanent accommodation could be established. The episode clearly delighted Roosevelt. "From this distance," he cabled Churchill on May 14th, "I can assure you that the Hess flight has captured the American imagination, and the story should be kept alive for just as many days or even weeks as possible." In reply, 2 days later, Churchill conveyed all he knew of the episode, including Hess's contention that, though Hitler was willing to seek peace, he would not negotiate with Churchill. Hess showed no ordinary signs of insanity, Churchill wrote. He cautioned that Roosevelt was to keep his letter confidential. Here, we think it best to let the press have a good run for a bit and keep the Germans guessing. And in this, Churchill's government succeeded. Questions abounded. One newspaper quipped, "Your Hess guess is as good as mine." There was speculation that Hess wasn't really Hess, but rather a clever double. Some feared that he might even be an assassin, whose true mission was to get close enough to Churchill to jab him with a poison ring. A London movie audience burst into a thunder of laughter when a newsreel announcer said that now England wouldn't be surprised if Hermann Göring himself arrived next. It all just seemed too incredible. "What a dramatic episode in this whole fascinating hell," wrote U.S. observer General Raymond Lee in his diary. Lee found that Hess's arrival was the talk of whites, where the constant repetition of Hess's name created a strange effect, filling the club's bar, lounge, and restaurant with sibilance, the hissing sound of repeated S's. "It sounded," Lee said, "like a basket full of snakes." And so, with family turmoil, civic trauma, and Hitler's deputy falling from the sky, the first year of Churchill's leadership came to an end. Against all odds, Britain stood firm, its citizens more emboldened than cowed. Somehow, through it all, Churchill had managed to teach them the art of being fearless. It is possible that the people would have risen to the occasion, no matter who had been there to lead them, but that is speculation, wrote Ian Jacob, military assistant secretary to the War Cabinet under Churchill, and later a lieutenant general. What we know is that the Prime Minister provided leadership of such outstanding quality that people almost revelled in the dangers of the situation and gloried in standing alone. Wrote War Cabinet Secretary Edward Bridges, only he had the power to make the nation believe that it could win. One Londoner, Nellie Carver, a manager in the Central Telegraph Office, may have put it best when she wrote, "Winston's speeches send all sorts of thrills racing up and down my veins, and I feel fit to tackle the largest Hun." On one of Churchill's full moon weekends at Ditchley, Diana Cooper, wife of Information Minister Duff Cooper, told Churchill that the best thing he had done was to give people courage. He did not agree. "I never gave them courage," he said. "I was able to focus theirs." In the end, London endured, albeit with grave injuries. Between September 7, 1940, when the first large-scale attack on central London occurred, and Sunday morning, May 11, 1941, when the Blitz came to an end, nearly 29,000 of its citizens were killed, and 28,556 seriously injured. No other British city experienced such losses, but throughout the United Kingdom, the total of civilian deaths in 1940 and 1941, including those in London, reached 44,652, with another 52,370 injured. Of the dead, 5,626 were children. Chapter 101. A Weekend at Chequers. It was a Sunday evening in December 1941, a few weeks before Christmas, and as always a host of familiar faces had made their way to Chequers to dine and sleep, or just to dine. The guests included Harriman and Pamela, as well as a new face, Harriman's daughter Kathy, who turned 24 that day. After dinner, Churchill's valet, Sawyers, brought in a radio, so that all present could listen to the BBC's regular broadcast of the news. The mood in the house was less than buoyant. Churchill seemed downhearted, though, in fact, the war, for the moment, was going reasonably well. Clementine had a cold and was upstairs in her room. The radio was an inexpensive portable, a gift to Churchill from Harry Hopkins. Churchill opened the top to turn it on. The broadcast was already underway. The announcer said something about Hawaii, then moved on to Tobruk and the Russian front. Hitler had launched his invasion in June, with a massive assault that most observers assumed would crush the Soviet army in a matter of months, if not weeks. But the army was proving more effective and resilient than anyone had expected, and now, in December, the invaders were struggling against the two eternal weapons of Russia, its sheer size and its winter weather. Hitler was still expected to win, however, and Churchill recognized that after completing his conquest, he would turn his full attention back to England.
As Churchill had forecast in a speech the previous summer, the Russian campaign is no more than a prelude to an attempted invasion of the British Isles. The BBC announcer's voice changed. "The news," he said, "has just been received that Japanese aircraft have raided Pearl Harbor, the American naval base in Hawaii. The announcement of the attack was made in a brief statement by President Roosevelt. Naval and military targets on the principal Hawaiian island of Oahu have also been attacked. No further details are yet available." At first, there was confusion. "I was thoroughly startled," Harriman said, "and I repeated the words. The Japanese have raided Pearl Harbor." "No, no," countered Churchill aide Tommy Thompson. "He said Pearl River." U.S. Ambassador John Wynant, also present, glanced toward Churchill. "We looked at one another incredulously," Wynant wrote. Churchill, his depression suddenly lifted, slammed the top of the radio down and leapt to his feet. His on-duty private secretary, John Martin, entered the room, announcing that the Admiralty was on the phone. As Churchill headed for the door, he said, "We shall declare war on Japan." Wynant followed, perturbed. "Good God," he said, "you can't declare war on a radio announcement." Later, Wynant wrote, "There is nothing half-hearted or unpositive about Churchill, certainly not when he is on the move." Churchill stopped. His voice quiet, he said, "What shall I do?" Wynant set off to call Roosevelt to learn more. "And I shall talk with him too," Churchill said. Once Roosevelt was on the line, Wynant told him that he had a friend with him who also wanted to speak. "You will know who it is as soon as you hear his voice." Churchill took the receiver. "Mr. President," he said, "what's this about Japan?" "It's quite true," Roosevelt said. "They have attacked us at Pearl Harbor. We are all in the same boat now." Roosevelt told Churchill that he would declare war on Japan the next day. Churchill promised to do likewise immediately after him. Late that night, at 1:35 a.m., Harriman and Churchill sent a most immediate telegram to Harry Hopkins. "Thinking of you much at this historic moment. Winston, Averill." The meaning was clear to all. The inevitable had finally arrived, Harriman said. We all knew the grim future that it held, but at least there was a future now. Anthony Eden, preparing to leave for Moscow, learned of the attack that night in a phone call from Churchill. "I could not conceal my relief, and did not have to try to," he wrote. "I felt that whatever happened now, it was merely a question of time." Later that night, Churchill at last retired to his room. "Being saturated and satiated with emotion and sensation," he wrote, "I went to bed and slept the sleep of the saved and thankful." Churchill worried briefly that Roosevelt would focus only on the Japanese, but on December 11th, Hitler declared war on America, and America returned the favor. Churchill and Roosevelt were indeed now all in the same boat. "It might be badly knocked about by the storm," wrote Pug Ismay, "but it would not capsize. There was no doubt about the end." Soon afterward, Churchill, Lord Beaverbrook, and Harriman set out for Washington, D.C., aboard a spanking new battleship, the Duke of York, at great risk and under strictest secrecy, to meet with Roosevelt and coordinate strategy for the war. Churchill's doctor, Sir Charles Wilson, came along, as did some 50 other men, ranging from valets to Britain's topmost military officials, Field Marshal Dill, First Sea Lord Pound, and Air Chief Marshal Portal. Lord Beaverbrook alone brought three secretaries, a valet and a porter. Roosevelt worried about the risk and tried to dissuade Churchill, for indeed, had the ship been sunk, the loss would have decapitated the British government. But Churchill brushed the president's concerns aside. Charles Wilson marvelled at the change in Churchill. "He is a different man since America came into the war," the doctor wrote. "The Winston I knew in London frightened me. I could see that he was carrying the weight of the world, and wondered how long he could go on like that, and what could be done about it. And now, in a night, it seems, a younger man has taken his place." The fun of it all was back, Wilson saw. Now suddenly the war is as good as won, and England is safe. To be Prime Minister of England in a great war, to be able to direct the Cabinet, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the House of Commons, England herself, is beyond even his dreams. He loves every minute of it. The first several days of the voyage were extraordinarily rough, even by North Atlantic standards, and forced the ship to sail at speeds as low as 6 knots, nullifying the hope for safety effect, of travelling in a ship capable of moving almost 5 times as fast. All of the travellers were ordered to stay off the deck, as massive waves swept over the ship's low-slung hull. Beaverbrook quipped that he had never travelled in such a large submarine. Churchill wrote to Clementine, "Being in a ship in such weather as this is like being in a prison, with the extra chance of being drowned." He took his mother's pills to fight seasickness and gave doses to his secretaries, against the protests of Wilson, who was chary about prescribing drugs of any kind. "The PM is very fit and cheerful," Harriman wrote, "talks incessantly at meals." At one point, Churchill held forth at length on the subject of seasickness. "Buckets on the bridge of destroyers, etc., etc.," wrote Harriman, until Dill, who had not fully recovered, turned green and almost left the table. The battleship anchored in the Chesapeake Bay off Maryland. Churchill and his party flew the rest of the way to Washington. "It was nighttime," Inspector Thompson wrote. "Those in the plane were transfixed with delight to look down from the windows and see the amazing spectacle of a whole city lighted up. Washington represented something immensely precious. Freedom, hope, strength. We had not seen an illuminated city for 2 years. My heart felt." Churchill stayed at the White House, as did Secretary Martin and several others, and got a close-up look at Roosevelt's own secret circle. Roosevelt, in turn, got a close-up look at Churchill. The first night Churchill and members of his party spent in the White House, Inspector Thompson, also one of the house guests, was with Churchill in his room, scouting various points of danger, when someone knocked at the door. At Churchill's direction, Thompson answered and found the president outside in his wheelchair, alone in the hall. Thompson opened the door wide, then saw an odd expression come over the president's face as he looked into the room behind the detective. "I turned," Thompson wrote. "Winston Churchill was stark naked, a drink in one hand, a cigar in the other." The president prepared to wheel himself out. "Come on in, Franklin," Churchill said. "We're quite alone." The president offered what Thompson called an odd shrug, then wheeled himself in. "You see, Mr. President," Churchill said, "I have nothing to hide." Churchill proceeded to sling a towel over his shoulder and for the next hour conversed with Roosevelt while walking around the room naked, sipping his drink and now and then refilling the president's glass. "He might have been a Roman at the baths, relaxing after a successful debate in the Senate," Inspector Thompson wrote. "I don't believe Mr. Churchill would have blinked an eye if Mrs. Roosevelt had walked in too." On Christmas Eve, Churchill, with Roosevelt standing at his side in leg braces, spoke from the south portico of the White House to a crowd of 30,000 people who had gathered for the lighting of the National Community Christmas Tree, an oriental spruce that had been transplanted to the south lawn. At twilight, after a prayer and remarks by a Girl Scout and a Boy Scout, Roosevelt pressed the button to turn on the lights. He spoke briefly, then offered the podium to Churchill, who told the audience that he felt very much at home in Washington. He spoke of this strange Christmas Eve, and how important it was to preserve Christmas as an island amid the storm. "Let the children have their night of fun and laughter," Churchill said. "Let gifts of Father Christmas delight their play. Let us, grown-ups, share to the full in their unstinted pleasures." Abruptly, he lowered his voice to a deep, forbidding growl. "Before we turn again to the stern tasks and formidable year that lie before us, resolve that by our sacrifice and daring, these same children shall not be robbed of their inheritance or denied their rights to live in a free and decent world." He closed, "And so," he flung his hand skyward, "and so, in God's mercy, a happy Christmas to you all." The crowd began to sing. 3 carols, starting with O Come All Ye Faithful, and closing with 3 verses of Silent Night, sung with solemnity by the massed voices of thousands of Americans facing a new war. Inspector Thompson was deeply touched when, the next day, just before setting out to have Christmas dinner with the chief of Roosevelt's Secret Service detail, a maid handed him a Christmas present from Mrs. Roosevelt. He unwrapped it and found a necktie and a small white envelope with a Christmas card. "For Inspector Walter Henry Thompson, Christmas 1941. A Merry Christmas from the President and Mrs. Roosevelt." The maid watched, fascinated, as Thompson's jaw dropped. He wrote, "I simply could not believe that the President of a nation, with his countrymen preparing to wage the greatest war in their history, could think of giving a necktie to a police officer on Christmas. What lay ahead, of course, was 4 more years of war, and for a time, the darkness seemed impenetrable. Singapore, Britain's stronghold in the Far East, fell, and threatened also to bring down Churchill's government. The Germans drove British forces from Crete and recaptured Tobruk. "We are indeed walking through the valley of humiliation," wrote Clementine in a letter to Harry Hopkins. Reversal followed reversal, but by the end of 1942, the momentum of the war began to shift in the Allies' favour. British forces defeated Rommel in a series of desert battles known collectively as the Battle of El Alamein. The US Navy bested Japan at Midway, and Hitler's Russian campaign slogged to a halt in mud, ice, and blood. By 1944, after the Allied invasions of Italy and France, the outcome seemed certain. The air war against Britain would briefly flare back to life with the advent, in 1944, of the V-1 flying bomb and the V-2 rocket, Hitler's vengeance weapons, which brought a fresh terror to London, but this was a final offensive begun for no other purpose than to cause death and destruction before Germany's inevitable defeat. On New Year's Eve 1941, Churchill and his party, and of course Inspector Thompson, were aboard a train heading back to Washington after a visit to Canada. Churchill sent a message to all, asking that they join him in the dining car. Drinks were served, and as midnight arrived, he offered a toast. "Here's to a year of toil, a year of struggle and peril, and a long step forward to victory." Then all joined hands, Churchill taking the hands of an RAF sergeant and Air Chief Marshal Charles Portal, and sang Auld Lang Syne as their train tore through the darkness toward that city of light. Epilogue. As time went by. Mary. Mary, the country mouse, became an anti-aircraft gunner assigned to the heavy gun battery in Hyde Park. This caused her mother no small degree of anxiety, especially after an 18-year-old member of a Southampton battery was killed during an air raid on April 17, 1942, the first such death of the war. "My first agonizing thought was, it might have been Mary," Clementine told her in a letter, but she also confessed to feeling private pride that you, my beloved one, have chosen this difficult, monotonous, dangerous, and most necessary work. "I think of you so often, my darling mouse." John Colville recalled how one evening, when air raid sirens began to sound, the PM dashed off in his car to Hyde Park to see Mary's battery at work. Mary was promoted and by 1944, the penultimate year of the war, found herself in command of 230 female volunteers. "Not so bad at 21, her father wrote proudly in a letter to Randolph. Winston Jr. was even more impressed. He understood that his grandfather was an important man, but it was his Aunt Mary he idolized. To a 3-year-old, having a grandfather who was Prime Minister and running the entire war was a concept difficult to grasp, he wrote in a memoir, but to have an aunt who had 4 huge guns of her very own, that was something. Eric Duncannon grieved the failure of his courtship, as became apparent on Saturday, September 6, 1941, when he and John Colville went shooting at Stansted Park with a group of friends. Wrote Colville, "Eric, who was at his simplest and most charming, told me he can still think of nothing but Mary Churchill." Colville. Churchill did, at last, relent. On Tuesday, July 8, 1941, in the midst of a heat wave, with temperatures in the 90s, John Colville stopped by Churchill's office just before his nap. "I hear you are plotting to abandon me," Churchill said. "You know I can't stop you. I can't make you stay with me against your will, but I can put you somewhere else." Colville told him he understood, but added that he hoped Churchill would not do so. He showed him one of his as-yet unfinished contact lenses. Churchill told Colville he could go. At last able to wear his lenses, Colville presented himself for another RAF medical interview, and this time, oh rapture, passed. Soon afterward, he was sworn in as a new member of the RAF Volunteer Reserve, the initial stop on his final journey to becoming a pilot. The RAF did insist, however, that first he have 2 teeth filled, something his dentist had previously told him not to worry about. This took an hour. At length, It came time for Colville's departure from 10 Downing Street, so that he could begin his training to become a fighter pilot. He could wear his contact lenses for only about 2 hours, and this, happily, disqualified him from serving on a bomber crew. Churchill agreed that the short, sharp battle of the fighter pilot was far better than the long wait of a bomber crew before they reached their objective. He was, however, appalled to learn that Colville would be doing his training not as an officer, but as the RAF's equivalent of an enlisted man, an aircraftman, second class. "You mustn't," Churchill told him. "You won't be able to take your man," wrote Colville. It had not crossed his mind that one of his junior private secretaries, earning £350 per annum, might not have his own valet. On September the 30th, after packing his things, Colville said a private goodbye to the Prime Minister in his office. Churchill was genial and gracious. He said it must only be au revoir, as he hoped I should often come back and see him. Churchill told Colville that he really should not be letting him leave, and that Anthony Eden had been annoyed at having to do so. But he conceded that Colville was doing a very gallant thing. As their meeting came to an end, Churchill told him, "I have the greatest affection for you. We all have. Clemmy and I especially. Goodbye, and God bless you." Colville left, feeling a great sadness. I went out of the room with a lump in my throat, such as I have not had for many years. Colville did not die in a fiery wreck after being shot to bits by an ME-109. He underwent his flight training and was assigned to a reconnaissance squadron flying American-made Mustangs, based in Funtington, adjacent to Stansted Park, where he contracted a case of impetigo. Lady Bessborough, Eric Duncannon's mother, invited him to stay in Stansted House to recuperate. A few weeks later, he received a summons from Churchill. "It is time that you came back here," Churchill told him. "But I have only done one operational flight." "Well, you may do six. Then back to work." After his six sorties, he returned to Downing Street to resume his work as private secretary. As D-Day neared, he was called back to his squadron over protests raised by the prof that if he were captured and identified, he would prove a valuable asset to German intelligence. Churchill let him go with reluctance. "You seem to think that this war is being fought for your personal amusement," he told him. "However, if I were your age, I should feel the same. And so you may have 2 months' fighting leave, but no more holidays this year." It was hardly a holiday. Colville flew 40 sorties over the French coast, conducting photographic reconnaissance. It was thrilling as we crossed the channel to look down on a sea boiling with ships of all kinds heading for the landing beaches, he wrote in his diary. It was thrilling, too, to be part of a vast aerial armada, bombers and fighters thick as starlings at roosting time, all flying southwards. 3 times he was nearly shot down. In a lengthy letter to Churchill, he described one incident in which an anti-aircraft shell tore a large hole through one wing. Churchill loved it. Once again, Colville came back to 10 Downing. Prior to his RAF tenure, he had been reasonably well-liked at No. 10, although never heartily loved, according to Pamela Churchill. But now that he had returned from active service, his cachet had risen. "None of us except Clemmy really liked Jock," Pamela said years later. "But he then went off and joined the Air Force. And I think that was a very smart thing to do, because when he came back again, everybody, you know, was so pleased to see him." He was no longer wet, as Mary had first judged him in the summer of 1940. "Nothing could have been less true," she conceded later. In 1947, Colville became private secretary to Princess Elizabeth, soon to be queen. The offer came as a surprise. "It is your duty to accept," Churchill told him. During his 2-year tenure in the post, Colville met and fell in love with one of the princess's ladies-in-waiting, Margaret Egerton. They married on October 20th, 1948, at St. Margaret's Church, adjacent to Westminster Abbey. Colville achieved a fame greater than any of his fellow private secretaries did when, in 1985, he published his diary, in edited form, under the title The Fringes of Power. The work became a touchstone for every scholar interested in the inner workings of 10 Downing Street under Churchill. He removed much personal material, trivial entries which are of no general interest, as he put it in his preface, though anyone reading the actual handwritten diary held in the Churchill Archive Centre in Cambridge, England, will see that those trivial entries were of the utmost importance to Colville himself. He dedicated the book to Mary Churchill, with affection and with penitence, for some of the less complimentary references to her in the early part of this diary. Beaverbrook. In all, Beaverbrook offered his resignation 14 times, the last in February 1942, when he was Minister of Supply. He resigned rather than take on a new post as Minister of War Production. This time Churchill did not object, doubtless to Clementine's delight. Beaverbrook left 2 weeks later. "I owe my reputation to you," he told Churchill in a letter on February 26th, his last day. "The confidence of the public really comes from you, and my courage was sustained by you." He told Churchill he was the saviour of our people and the symbol of resistance in the free world. Churchill replied in kind, "We have lived and fought side by side through terrible days, and I am sure our comradeship and public work will undergo no break. All I want you to do now is to recover your strength and poise, so as to be able to come to my aid when I shall very greatly need you." He credited Beaverbrook's triumph in the fall of 1940 with playing a decisive part in our salvation. He closed, "You are one of our very few fighting men of genius." And so Beaverbrook at last departed. "I felt his loss acutely," Churchill wrote. But in the end, Beaverbrook had succeeded where he'd needed to succeed, doubling fighter output within his first 3 months as Minister of Aircraft Production, and, perhaps just as important, standing near at hand to provide the kind of counsel and humour that helped Churchill through his days. What Churchill most valued was Beaverbrook's companionship and the diversion he provided. "I was glad to be able, sometimes, to lean on him," Churchill wrote. In March 1942, Beaverbrook felt compelled to explain to Churchill why he had made all those previous threats to resign. He acknowledged using them as a tool to overcome delays and opposition, in short, to get his way, and he believed that Churchill had understood that. "I was always under the impression," he wrote, "that in your support for my methods, you wished me to stay on in office, to storm, to threaten resignation, and to withdraw again." The two men remained friends, though the intensity of their friendship ebbed and flowed. In September 1943, Churchill brought him back into his government as Lord Privy Seal, a move that seemed designed mainly to keep his friend and adviser close at hand. Beaverbrook resigned from this as well, but by then Churchill too was leaving office. In one volume of his personal history of World War II, Churchill gave high praise to Beaverbrook. "He did not fail," he wrote. "This was his hour." The Prof. The Prof was vindicated. At length, Mr. Justice Singleton felt confident enough about the various statistics of German and British air strength to offer a judgment. "The conclusion at which I arrive," he wrote in his final report in August 1941, "is that the strength of the German Air Force in relation to the Royal Air Force may be taken as roughly 4-3, as at the 30th November 1940, meaning that all along, as the RAF fought what it believed to be an overwhelming foe, the two air forces did not differ much in terms of strength, the main variance, as Singleton now concluded, being in the numbers of long-range bombers. This comforting news came a bit late, of course, but in the end it may well be that the RAF, thinking itself the underdog by a ratio of 4-1, fought better and with more urgency than might have been the case if it had shared the relative complacency of the Luftwaffe, which believed itself to be vastly superior. The report proved that the Prof's instincts had been accurate after all. His embrace of aerial mines did not have as salutary an outcome. Throughout 1940 and 1941, he and Churchill lobbied and cajoled air ministry officials and Beaverbrook to produce and deploy the mines, and to make them a staple in Britain's arsenal of defensive weapons. He had few successes, many failures, and in the end, faced with increasing resistance, the mines were abandoned. Lindemann and Churchill remained friends throughout the war, and Lindemann was a regular guest for meals, vegetarian meals, at 10 Downing Street, Chequers and Ditchley. Pamela and Averill. For a time, the affair between Pamela Churchill and Averill Harriman flourished. Harriman's daughter, Kathy, caught on to their relationship soon after her arrival in London and did not mind. The fact that she herself was several years older than her father's lover seemed not to trouble her. Kathy was not particularly close to her own stepmother, Marie, and felt no sense of betrayal. That Kathy should grasp the reality so quickly surprised no one. The couple made little effort to disguise the affair.
Indeed, at one point, for about 6 months, Harriman, Pamela and Kathy shared a three-bedroom flat at 3 Grosvenor Square, near the American Embassy. Churchill knew of the affair, Pamela believed, but he expressed no outward concern. If anything, so strong a bond between a member of the Churchill family and Roosevelt's personal emissary could only be an asset. Clementine did not approve, but also did nothing to intercede. Randolph later complained to John Colville that his parents had condoned adultery beneath their own roof. Beaverbrook knew of it, and loved knowing of it, and made sure that Harriman and Pamela spent long weekends at his country home, Chartley, where Winston Jr. continued to reside in the care of a nanny. Harry Hopkins knew about the affair, and so even did Roosevelt. The president was tickled. In June 1941, Churchill sent Harriman to Cairo to assess how American aid could best buttress Britain's forces in Egypt, and asked his son, Randolph, to look out for him. By now, Randolph had been promoted to major, assigned to manage press relations at British headquarters in Cairo. He was himself conducting a love affair, this with a celebrated hostess named Momo Marriott, wife of a British general. One night, while talking with Harriman during a dinner on a chartered dhow on the Nile River, which Randolph had arranged just for the visiting American, Randolph boasted about his own affair. He had no inkling that Harriman was sleeping with his wife, even though it was a source of gossip within his circle and at White's Club back in London. Randolph's lack of awareness was evident in a letter he wrote to Pamela in July 1941, which he entrusted to Harriman to deliver to her upon his return from Cairo. The letter praised Harriman. "I found him absolutely charming," Randolph wrote, "and it was lovely to be able to hear so much news of you and all my friends. He spoke delightfully about you, and I fear that I have a serious rival." Randolph finally learned of the affair early in 1942, while on leave. He had by then grown dissipated in appearance. Their marriage, already wounded by his spending and drinking and Pamela's indifference, now veered into a miasma of argument and insult. Furious battles broke out at the annex, during which Randolph would pick fights with Churchill. Clementine, concerned that her husband might suffer an apoplectic seizure, again banished Randolph from the house, this time for the duration of the war. By the summer, when Randolph returned to London to convalesce from injuries sustained in a car crash in Cairo, it was clear to all that the marriage could not be repaired. Evelyn Waugh, one of Randolph's clubmates at White's, wrote of Pamela, "She hates him so much she can't be in a room with him." In November 1942, Randolph left her. Harriman moved her into an apartment of her own and paid her an annual allowance of £3,000, $168,000 in today's dollars. To disguise his role, he used an intermediary, Max Beaverbrook, who, true always to his love of human drama, was glad to do it, and worked out a scheme to camouflage the fact that Harriman was providing the money. But this, too, was not exactly a secret. Unlike Paris, where there was a great black market, everybody took pride in sticking pretty closely to rationing, said John Colville. But if you dined with Pamela, you would have a 5 or 6 course dinner, 8 or 10 guests, and foods you didn't ordinarily see. My guess is that all of us around the table were sort of smirking and saying that Averill was taking good care of his girlfriend. In October 1943, Roosevelt picked Harriman to be his ambassador to Moscow, and the affair inevitably began to cool. Distance freed them both. Harriman slept with other women, Pamela with other men, including at one point broadcaster Edward R. Murrow. "I mean, when you are very young, you do think of things very differently," Pamela told a later interviewer. As the war neared its end, Pamela felt a growing anxiety about what would come next. On April 1st, 1945, she wrote to Harriman in Moscow, "Supposing the war ends in the next 4 or 5 weeks. The thought of it sort of scares me. It is something one has looked forward to for so long that when it happens, I know I am going to be frightened. Do you know at all what I mean? My adult life has been all war, and I know how to grapple with that, but I am afraid of not knowing what to do with life in peacetime. It scares me horribly. It's silly, isn't it?" Years passed. Harriman went on to become U.S. Secretary of Commerce under President Harry Truman, and later was elected Governor of New York. He held various senior advisory posts in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. He nursed grander aspirations, however, to become Secretary of State, maybe even President,
but these proved beyond his reach. Despite his many affairs, he remained married to his wife, Marie, and, by all counts, their marriage grew stronger over the years. Marie's death in September 1970 left Harriman shattered, according to Marie's daughter, Nancy. He used to sit in her room and cry. In 1960, Pamela married Leland Haywood, the producer and talent agent who co-produced the original Broadway version of The Sound of Music. Their marriage lasted until Haywood's death in March 1971. Pamela and Harriman kept in distant touch. In August 1971, they both found themselves invited to a Washington, D.C. dinner party thrown by a mutual friend, Catherine Graham, publisher of the Washington Post. Harriman was 79 years old, Pamela 51. They spent the evening in close conversation. "It was very strange," she said, "because the moment we started talking, there were so many things to reminisce about that one really hadn't thought about for years." 8 weeks later, they married, in a private ceremony at a church on Manhattan's Upper East Side, attended by only 3 guests. They wanted the ceremony kept secret, but only for the moment. Later that day, about 150 friends gathered at Harriman's nearby townhouse for what they had been told was just a cocktail party. As Pamela walked in, she cried out to a friend, "We did it! We did it!" It had taken only 3 decades. "Oh, Pam," another friend wrote soon afterward, "isn't life strange?" Their marriage endured for another 15 years, until Harriman's death in July 1986. The Germans. At the Nuremberg trials, Hermann Göring was found guilty of an array of offences, including war crimes and crimes against humanity. The court sentenced him to die by hanging on October 16, 1946. In his testimony, he stated that he had wanted to invade England immediately after Dunkirk, but had been overruled by Hitler. He told an American interrogator, U.S. Air Force General Karl Spatz, that he had never liked the idea of attacking Russia. He wanted to keep bombing England and drive Churchill to capitulate. "The timing of the Russian campaign was fatal," Göring told Spatz. "Only the diversion of the Luftwaffe to the Russian front saved England." To the last, Göring was unrepentant. He told the Nuremberg court, "Of course we rearmed. I am only sorry we did not rearm more. Of course I considered treaties as so much toilet paper. Of course I wanted to make Germany great." Göring also sought to justify his systematic looting of art collections throughout Europe. While awaiting trial, he told an American psychiatrist, "Perhaps one of my weaknesses has been that I love to be surrounded by luxury, and that I am so artistic in temperament that masterpieces make me feel alive and glowing inside." He claimed that all along he'd intended to donate his collections to a state museum after his death. "Looking at it from that standpoint, I can't see that it was ethically wrong. It was not as if I accumulated art treasures in order to sell them or to become a rich man. I love art for art's sake, and as I said, my personality demanded that I be surrounded with the best specimens of the world's art." Investigators catalogued the works he had amassed since the war began and counted 1,375 paintings, 250 sculptures, 108 tapestries, 200 pieces of period furniture, 60 Persian and French rugs, 75 stained glass windows, and 175 miscellaneous other objects. The night before his execution, he killed himself with cyanide. Joseph Goebbels and his wife Magda poisoned their 6 youngest children, Helga, Hildegard, Helmut, Hordina, Hedwig, and Heidrun, on May 1, 1945, in Hitler's bunker, as the Soviet army closed in, first directing a medical adjutant to administer a shot of morphine to each child. Next, Hitler's personal doctor gave each an oral dose of cyanide. Goebbels and Magda then killed themselves, also using cyanide. An SS officer, acting on their instructions, shot them both to make certain they were dead. Hitler had killed himself the day before. Rudolf Hess was tried at Nuremberg, where he avowed his continued loyalty to Hitler. "I do not regret anything," he said. He was sentenced to life in prison for his role in helping bring about the war and was assigned to Spandau prison, along with 6 other German officials. One by one, the other prisoners, including Albert Speer, were released until, on September 30, 1966, Hess became the prison's sole occupant. He committed suicide on August 17, 1987, at the age of 93, using an extension cord to hang himself. Miraculously, Adolf Galland survived the war, despite a number of near-death encounters. On one day alone, he was shot down twice. He achieved his final kills on April 25, 1945, when, while flying the Luftwaffe's most advanced fighter, a jet aircraft, he shot down two American bombers, bringing his score to 104. After destroying the second aircraft, he was intercepted by an American P-47. Wounded, his plane badly damaged, he managed to return to his airfield just as it came under attack and crash-landed with bombs and bullets falling around him. He survived with only a leg injury. American forces arrested him 10 days later. He was 33 years old. As good as his record was, it by now had been exceeded by a number of his colleagues. Two pilots accumulated more than 300 kills each, and 92 other men matched or exceeded Galland's record. After first being interrogated in Germany, Galland was flown to England on May 14, 1945, for further questioning. This was his first visit on land. In July, his captors took him to the big airbase at Tangmere, near Stansted Park, where he met the legless ace, Douglas Bader, with whom Mary Churchill had danced. Galland had met Bader earlier in the war, after Bader had been shot down and captured. Galland had insisted he be treated well. Now Bader gave him cigars. Churchill and the War. The boy never left the man. One morning in the summer of 1944, with the war still in full flare, Clementine, in her bed at the No. 10 Annex, summoned to her room a teenage soldier named Richard Hill, the son of Churchill's personal secretary, Mrs. Hill. A toy train set had arrived for Winston Jr., Pamela's son, and Clementine wanted to make sure all the pieces were present and that everything worked. She asked Hill to assemble it and try it out. The package contained tracks, train cars, and two engines, which were powered by wind-up mechanisms. Hill, on his knees, began laying out the track, and as he did so, he noticed the appearance on the floor before him of two slippers bearing the monogram WSC. He looked up and saw Churchill standing above, in his pale blue siren suit, smoking a cigar and closely watching his progress. Hill made a move to stand up, but the Prime Minister stopped him. "Carry on with what you are doing," Churchill said. Hill completed the layout. Churchill continued watching. "Put one of the engines on the track," he said. Hill did so. The engine moved around the circle as its clockwork wound down. "I see you have two engines," Churchill said. "Put the other one on the track as well." Hill again obliged. Now two engines traveled the tracks, one behind the other. Churchill, cigar in his mouth, got down on his hands and knees. With obvious delight, he said, "Now, let's have a crash." The war in Europe ended on May 8, 1945. Throughout the day, as the news spread through London, crowds began filling the city squares. Cocky American soldiers threaded through the crowd, waving American flags, and now and then breaking into the song, "Over There." Germany's surrender was official. Churchill was to make a public speech at 3 o'clock from Downing Street, to be broadcast by the BBC and through loudspeakers, after which he would proceed to the House of Commons. At the sound of Big Ben booming 3 o'clock, the crowd went utterly silent. The German war, Churchill said, was over. He summarized the war's course and explained how, in the end, almost the whole world was combined against the evildoers who are now prostrate before us. He tempered this news with the sober reflection that Japan had yet to surrender. "We must now devote all our strength and resources to the completion of our task, both at home and abroad. Advance, Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom! God save the King!" The staff at No. 10 made a path for him in the back garden and applauded as he walked to his car. He was touched. "Thank you so much," he said. "Thank you so much." At Buckingham Palace, as the King and Queen appeared on the royal balcony, a vast crowd on the Mall erupted with one fused scream of delight and continued clapping and cheering and waving flags until the royal couple went back inside. But the crowd lingered and began chanting, "We want the King! We want the King!" At length, the King and Queen reappeared, then stepped apart to make room for another, and out walked Winston Churchill, an immense smile on his face. The roar was explosive. That night, even though the blackout was officially still in effect, bonfires erupted throughout London, casting a familiar orange glow of fire into the sky. Except now the fires were a sign of celebration. Searchlights played on Nelson's Tower in Trafalgar Square, and in perhaps the most moving gesture of all, the searchlight operators aimed their lights at a space in the air just above the cross that topped the dome to St. Paul's Cathedral and held them there to form a shining cross of light. Just 2 months later, in an episode of breathtaking irony, the British public voted the Conservative Party out of power, forcing Churchill's resignation. He had seemed the ideal man to run a war, less so to guide Britain's post-war recovery. Churchill was succeeded by Clement Attlee, leader of the Labour Party, which won 393 seats. The Conservatives held only 213. The final results of the vote were reported on July 26th, a Thursday. A few days later, the Churchills and some friends gathered for the last weekend at Chequers. The house filled as always. Here came Colville, Ambassador Wynant, Brendan Bracken, Randolph, Mary, Sarah and Diana, with her husband Duncan Sands. The Prof arrived for lunch. The rector of the Ellsborough Church, so rarely attended by Churchill, stopped by to say farewell. That Saturday night, after dinner and after watching newsreels and a documentary about the Allied victory in Europe called The True Glory, the family went downstairs. Suddenly, Churchill seemed downhearted. He told Mary, "This is where I miss the news. No work. Nothing to do." She poured her sadness for her father into her diary. It was an agonizing spectacle to watch this giant among men, equipped with every faculty of mind and spirit, wound to the tightest pitch, walking unhappily round and round, unable to employ his great energy and boundless gifts, nursing in his heart a grief and disillusion I can only guess at. "It was the worst moment so far," she wrote. The family played records to cheer him, first Gilbert and Sullivan, which for the first time had little effect, followed by American and French military marches, which helped a bit. Then came Run, Rabbit, Run, and at Churchill's request, a song from The Wizard of Oz, and these seemed at last to do the trick. "Finally, at 2, he was soothed enough to feel sleepy and want his bed," Mary wrote. "We all escorted him upstairs." She added, "Oh, darling Papa, I love you so, so much, and it breaks my heart to be able to do so little. I went to bed feeling very tired and dead inside me." The next day, after lunch, Mary and John Colville took a last walk up Beacon Hill. It was a lovely, sun-filled day. Everyone gathered on the lawn. Clementine played croquet with Duncan, by now largely recovered from his car crash. They all signed the Chequers visitor's book. The memorable visitor's book, Mary noted, where you can follow the plots and stratagems of the war from the names there. In a thank you to the estate's owners, the Lees, Clementine wrote, "Our last weekend at Chequers was sad, but as we all wrote our names in the visitor's book, I reflected upon the wonderful part this ancient house has played in the war. What distinguished guests it has sheltered, what momentous meetings it has witnessed, what fateful decisions have been taken under its roof." Churchill was the last to sign. He added beneath his name a single word, Finney. December 24, 1941.
Fellow workers, in the cause of freedom, I have the honor to add a pendant to the necklace of Christmas goodwill and kindliness which my illustrious friend, the President, has encircled the homes and families of the United States by his message of Christmas Eve, which he has just delivered. I spend this anniversary and festival far from my country, far from my family, And yet, I cannot truthfully say that I feel far from home. Whether it be by the ties of blood on my mother's side, or the friendships I have developed here over many years of active life, or the commanding sentiment of comradeship in the common cause of great peoples who speak the same language, who kneel at the same altars, and to a very large extent pursue the same ideals, whichever it may be, or all of them together, I cannot feel myself a stranger here in the center and at the summit of the United States. I feel a sense of unity and fraternal association, which, added to the kindliness of your welcome, convinces me that I have a right to sit at your fireside and share your Christmas joys. Fellow workers, fellow soldiers in the cause, this is a strange Christmas Eve. Almost the whole world is locked in deadly struggle. Armed with the most terrible weapons which science can devise, the nations advance upon each other. Ill would it be for us this Christmastide if we were not sure that no greed for the lands or wealth of any other people, no vulgar ambition, no morbid lust for material gain at the expense of others had led us to the field. Ill would it be for us if that were so. Here in the midst of war, raging and roaring over all the lands and seas, creeping nearer to our hearths and homes, here amid all these tumults, we have tonight the peace of the spirit in each cottage home and in every generous heart. Therefore, we may cast aside, for this night at least, the cares and dangers which beset us, and make for the children an evening of happiness in a world of storm. Here then, for one night only, each home throughout the English-speaking world should be a brightly lighted island of happiness and peace. Let the children have their night of fun and laughter. Let the gifts of Father Christmas delight their play. Let us, grown-ups, share to the full in their unstinted pleasures. Before we turn again to the stern tasks and formidable year that lie before us, resolve that by our sacrifice and daring, these same children shall not be robbed of their inheritance or denied their right to live in a free and decent world. And so, in God's mercy, a happy Christmas to you all.
This is John Lee. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Splendid and the Vile, a saga of Churchill, family, and defiance during the Blitz by Eric Larson.
This program was directed by John Doolittle. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright, 2020 by Eric Larson. Production copyright, 2020, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.